This is Vic. Welcome to Baseball Memory. How you doing, Lee Lonefish, the author of Branch Rickey?
I'm fine. Good to be with you tonight.
Just so everybody knows, it's Lee Lonefish, famed author, wrote the award-winning book Branch Rickey, Baseball's Ferocious Gentleman. The book won a Choice Award from the American Library Association and the coveted Seymour Medal from SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research.
I'm fine, thanks. Another good season ahead, and I love the history of baseball, and I love watching contemporary baseball at all level, not just the major leagues.
Well, I loved your book. I actually read your book.
Well, you know, it's an amazing life. People have said, and I agree, that it's amazing he poured so much into his 83 years and almost 84 on this earth, you know. And as I began the book, he died basically giving a speech on courage in Missouri, where he had had his first fame. So it was almost the story of his is a full circle in many ways. And the Jackie Robinson story, I think, is what he's most known for, but that was only 8 years of his life, and he had the whole farm system that put St. Louis on the map, and that's still very relevant to today's baseball. And then the last years of his life, he tried to create the Continental League and didn't succeed, but it did force the expansion of baseball into cities that wanted the major leagues and had been denied for so long. So it was quite a life, and I'm glad you enjoyed my rendering of it.
Now, you had actually done some work about him before, and you wanted to expand on that, right?
Right. I did it. I got back into the history of baseball in the mid-90s. I had written a book in the 1980, The Imperfect Diamond, The Labor History of Baseball. And in that book, Branch Rickey was kind of not one of the good guys because he had, was so conservative on labor issues in baseball. But the more I saw throughout the 80s and 90s how the wars between players and owners off the field were hurting my interest in the game itself, I began to understand why Rickey was so conservative on those labor issues while he was innovative in so many other ways, like the farm system, like creating batting helmets and batting cages and aggressive play on the field, and, of course, opening up the game to the most discriminated against minority, the African-American population. So he was quite a challenge and an adventure to bring back to life, and I'm glad I was able to pull it off.
Now, I also saw a part about where he had a trainer with a psychology degree, too.
Oh, yes. One of his coaches and scouts, Rex Bowen, who I got to know before he passed away, and his grandson is now a Pirate scout, used to be a Mets scout. Rex Bowen said that he could have gotten a doctorate in psychology and counseling, but he thought working alongside Branch Rickey was a practical way of and in uniform of doing the same kind of thing, because nobody, I think, understood the mental side of baseball as well as Branch Rickey and his associates.
Now, how did you get an interest in Branch Rickey? What was your history of getting into baseball?
Well, I'm speaking to you from New York City tonight, and I just turned 68 on Sunday. And I'm old enough to remember when there were three teams in New York. And my first game was six. I was 6 years old, and I went to see the Boston Braves play the New York Giants. And Johnny Antonelli was a bonus baby for the Giants, for the Braves, rather. Later, he became a great pitcher for the New York Giants and the San Francisco Giants. But that was my first game. I still remember seeing the field of grass through the concrete in this very urban part of Manhattan. And I saw my first Yankee game in 1949 and my first Dodger game at Ebbets Field the next year. So I've been hooked on this sport since I was in knee pants. I never was much of a player, unfortunately, but I've followed it in many ways. And when I went out to Wisconsin for grad school in the 60s, I was always finding time to get to Milwaukee when they still had the Braves, and then Chicago wasn't that far away, so I saw the White Sox and the Cubs. And then I also saw some American League teams in Milwaukee when the White Sox played 9 games there before when they were threatening to leave Chicago. So, and then I came to Baltimore where I was teaching at Goucher College in Towson, and also at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and that's where I became an Oriole fan. And I have to admit, Zeke, that I am still an Oriole fan, but how the mighty have fallen. They were built on pitching, defense, and three-run homers, and now they have very little of any of it, you know. And yet, but, you know, this is all part of the saga of baseball, and that's why I never could root for the Yankees, because the Yankees have this outrageous sense of entitlement. And
I have to totally agree with you. My producer, though, is probably very furious right now.
He's a Yankee fan. Not at all. To interrupt very quickly, I admire that, you know, someone else can actually root for someone other than the Yankees. I mean, someone has to root for someone else, you know, or everyone else.
Well,
Now, I just wanted to ask you, you said you've been to Ebbets Field. I was wondering if you've been to Citi Field, which is supposed to, you know, be the same as Ebbets.
Well, yes, I've been there. I haven't been there this year. I went there a couple of times last year. It's an improvement on Shea Stadium, but it's the problem with the new ballparks, and certainly the new Yankee Stadium is in this category, is that for all the newness and the all the concessions you can buy, you know, and foods from all over the world, there are a lot. The cheaper seats are in what I would call nosebleed areas. So that saddens me, and I think it's one of the reasons I prefer, in a lot of ways, going to minor league games these days, because you're so much closer to the action, and you remember what baseball was like when you fell in love with it. You know, that the players were the same size as you. They're far more athletic and talented. Now it's a spectacle. And the sound systems are incredibly loud. And as I said, it seems to be there's more emphasis on the selling of concession than there is to watching the beauty and the difficulty and the excitement of the game itself. So I give Citi Field a passing grade, but I wish it were more intimate, and too many of these new fields aren't. Now, the exceptions, of course, are the one in Pittsburgh, which is a great sports town, and I wish that team, that organization has had as many losing years now as the Orioles, and which is sad because it's a great sports town. But that ballpark is wonderful. And I think it's one of the few new ballparks that hasn't changed their name. It's still PNC Park on the three rivers of the Ohio, the Monongahela, and the Allegheny. And I highly recommend seeing that one. I also like the one in San Francisco that I saw once the year that it opened 10 years ago. And that's a marvelous celebration of that city, where you can see the Oakland Bay Bridge from back of first base. And for those of you listening tonight who could who see that field on TV, that Coke bottle that's way out in left field is really an amusement park for the kids. And so that's a wonderful touch. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, if Branch Rickey were alive today, how he would like baseball. And I think he would love a lot of these new stadiums, and I think he would love the international play that has come, because he didn't succeed directly in rebuilding the Pirates in his last big job, but he did create the team that won the World Series and beat the Yankees in 1960. I mean, Dick Grote, who I interviewed for my book, he signed right out of Duke, and he never played in the minor leagues. And he plucked the Roberto Clemente out of the Dodger farm system, as he did Roy Face, who became the great relief pitcher. And he signed Mazeroski and Bob Skinner as a farm hand. So he really did succeed in Pittsburgh, although he wasn't around to enjoy it. And he also was, when the Pirates fielded the team of all blacks in the later 60s, that was partly because the Pirates, under Ricky's guidance in the 1950s, became colorblind, and they looked for the best players regardless of the color of the pigmentation of their skin, as Branch Rickey would put it. And he was an amazingly eloquent man, as you could see after reading my book. I mean, he had he could have been a preacher if he had wanted that to be his living. And as it was, he was a really great lay preacher, and major ministers like Norman Vincent Peale and Ralph Sockman considered him a friend. And they all went to Ohio Wesleyan, too, where Ricky had been both a player and a coach. So I believe that when you look at the full picture of Branch Rickey, he wanted to be a consistent player and a consistent Christian. That's what he told the sports writer who was interviewing him during his brief major league career in the early 20th century. And he didn't like the question coming up about does religion and baseball mix, because he thought religion was very private. But he saw no reason one couldn't be a religious person off the field and a great fiery competitor on the field. And I think that's another part of his story that is worth recounting, as I did in my book.
Well, I think that's why he's called the Ferocious Gentleman, because he's a wonderful man. But when it comes down to it, you know, he gets down to business. I think a quote, one of the quotes, I forget what player it was, said he had a heart of gold, but he'll keep it.
Well, that's the controversial side of Ricky that I, until I got deeply into his story, I had been willing to say that was the dominant part of his personality. It was Gene Hermansky who played for him in Brooklyn and in Pittsburgh, and he said that he had a heart of gold and he kept it. And Ricky's successes occurred in the heyday of the reserve system. And it was an unfair system for most players. But the more I got into his story and the more I understand the excesses that exist now under the current system, I understand better where Ricky was coming from. I mean, he was to expect him to be much different, I think, would be like expecting Louis the 14th or Louis the 16th to have feeling for the masses. And yet, you see, this is the thing about Ricky that fascinated me. And one of the sports writers referred to him as a warm iceberg, and that was another term I thought I might use for the book, because Bill Corum was that sports writer who called Ricky the warm iceberg, and that's almost as contradictory as Ferocious Gentleman. And what he meant was that Ricky was a former catcher, stocky man. When you met him, you realized that if you tangled with him, you would be like hitting an iceberg. It would be menacing and hard. But the more you talked to him, he was a warm person. He wanted to know everything about you. And as somebody said of him, he wanted to know everything about you and then make you better. And that is what I try to bring out in the book. And the Jackie Robinson story and that first meeting, which, you know, movies have been made about and plays and hundreds, thousands of articles. That meeting when he asked Jackie, "Do you have a girl? And you know why I called you here? And are you have him looking for somebody who has the guts not to fight back?" Well, he did that to almost everyone he ever met. And accepting the Robinson story had the great historic importance, because there's just no doubt that if Ricky and Robinson had not met in that historic part of the end of World War II, a lot of baseball and a lot of the country would have been different. I mean, I think the change would have come, but I don't think it would have come as successfully as it did in Brooklyn with Robinson.
We're going to take a break here, but I just want to let you know that there are a bunch of listeners listening to the show. I mean, we have a lot of listeners right now. I just want to give a shout-out to my pals, my buddies in the press box at the Renegades game. I don't know if it's still going on or if they won or lost, but I have a little treat for them. I'm going to play it right now. The Renegades. Lee Lonefish knows of the Renegades. That's where we met, and he gave me his book. And I just want to get back to the book. Talking about the tryout camps, there was also Japanese that were taken from the internment camps.
Right. That was one of the things I was happy to dig up. When Ricky came to Brooklyn from St. Louis at the end of the 1942 season, He pledged to the owners of the Dodgers that he was going to build a farm system that was going to be as successful as the one in St. Louis, and it was going to be frugal, and so the owners could make money, and the team would compete for pennants. And he also said he was going to scout players of color, and the owners said, fine, this is the war going on where there are race riots beginning to happen in World War II, and as long as the player you choose wants to succeed within a team framework, it's fine. And also, Ricky sent letters to the internment camps where the Japanese Americans had been rounded up in the aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack by the Japanese in Hawaii. And Ricky's letter said simply, they're American boys. If they're athletes and they want to play baseball, let them come to the tryout camps. And none of them made the majors, and I'm not sure any were actually signed, but they actually did come to the tryout camps. So he always argued, Ricky, that the tryout camps were the genesis of the farm system, because he saw that there were so many people wanting to play the game, and they had raw ability, but, you know, to play baseball well requires a lot of training and a lot of practice and a lot of experience in the field. And so he created farm teams to fulfill that need, and also, as always with Ricky, as these farm teams were created, he got on the board of these teams, and it was another way to augment his income. So that was his triumph. And through the 1950, he was very successful in Brooklyn. But then he ran afoul of Walter O'Malley, who wanted to make more money from the team than Ricky wanted. And as so often happens in history, Zeke, you know, you have strong men in one organization, and it's very difficult for two strong men to work side by side, and that's what happened, and Ricky was forced out. But to O'Malley's credit, I mean, he did not break down the farm system. He kept it going, and as a result, you know, the Dodgers were a dominant team from the 1940s really into through the 1980s, and the Dodger way still is a based on pitching and defense and speed remains a very, very big part of baseball tradition.
I thought it was funny that that at least that one reporter and other people did call him El Cheapo, even though he made a lot of money himself.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing with Ricky, and this is something I brought out in the book from his earliest days, really, as a coach at the University of Michigan, he always had problems with riders. It was a character trait that, as I mentioned in the book, was not his his best trait. I don't know if doing a little psychoanalyst work here, he could have been a lawyer, and he loved to read. He did not like to write at all, and so he admired journalists and writers who were very fluent with words. So he had those problems. I mean, and in New York, you know, one of the ironies is that Jimmy Powers was a very powerful sports editor in the Daily News, the biggest tabloid in New York City. He's the one who coined El Cheapo, and he kept it going to the point where Ricky even thought about suing him, which really would have been a great mistake, and he didn't do it. And I say it's an irony because Jimmy Powers was one of the sports writers in the 1930s, along with Shirley Povich in Washington, D.C., who made an issue of why is baseball segregated. And so it was Branch Rickey, though, who was the one person in power who made the choice to bring in blacks and defy the gentleman's agreement against it. And since the book came out, I've written some more about this area because I think the area of the 1940s and 50s is the pivotal period of our modern age. And the question has come up, what if Commissioner Landis had lived? And how would he have been reacted to the contract of Jackie Robinson? And I had an interesting email exchange later this year, earlier this year, with an 86-year-old nephew of Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and he said this was a great question. Now, I think that Landis could not have done very much about it because all the federal and state laws were on Ricky's side. As I point out very clearly in my book, that once the Ives-Quinn law was passed in New York State, which made discrimination against minorities a crime, you know, Ricky could cite that, you know. And not only did he sign, of course, Robinson, but he quickly signed Campanella and Newcomb, who would be in the minor leagues at a lower level in 46. And so I think, I don't think Landis could have done much, but he certainly would have tried to do something, you know. As it turned out, you know, it was a success. And I've written about Horace Stoneham. Once he saw how successful the Dodgers were with the black players, he started bringing in black players by 49 with the New York Giants. And that was Monty Irvin, Hank Thompson, and then, of course, by 51, Willie Mays. So that was a really great, great period in our history. And the sadness of it is that by the end of 57, both teams were going to the West Coast.
I just want to give an update. The Hudson Valley Renegades beat Aberdeen 3-2. So congratulations.
Oh, and I can update that the Rays just went ahead of the Twins 3-2 at Minnesota in the top of the seventh.
That's ironic.
And I think some of the Rays on that, at least Shields, I know, and a couple others, played in Hudson Valley. And
there were
I hope to be there for the honoring of Bobby Miskey next week, next Saturday.
Oh, good.
I just think it's wonderful what the Gold Clan group under with Tyler Tamini's great organization skills, how they're honoring scouts all over the country, you know, because, you know, Ricky loved his scouts and was very loyal to his scouts. And you really, without the good scouting, you just cannot build a successful team. And one of the reasons, whether your producer agrees with me or not, that I can't look for the Yankees again, is that they're just writing up the big checks for the big ticket free agents. You know, that's one element of the baseball world that I think would stun Branch Rickey today. But I do think he would still feel that development, scouting and development, would be the key to lasting success if you can hold on to your players. And of course, that in the where free agency now is rife everywhere, that becomes a tremendous problem.
I just wanted to let you know, I'll be looking forward to seeing you because I will be there on the 10th for that. And you might want to listen in on the 15th because I'm having Bob Miskey on.
Oh, great.
10 o'clock, so you could even call in if you want and talk to him.
Great.
Two things about the book. One that I found funny, I can't remember who it was, but somebody, when they said about Jackie Robinson being called up, somebody said, as long as he isn't with the Dodgers, I don't care.
Well, that was Dixie Walker. And you know, I think Dixie Walker has been somewhat over maligned. You see, I mean, you know, to me, the greatness of Rickey with this program is that he wanted people to express themselves. And, you know, and Walker actually put in writing that he didn't want to play with Robinson. And yet once he did play with him, he admitted that he was a great player, and he would have played with him for another year, but he wanted to continue his career, so Rickey traded him to Pittsburgh, not because he had initially opposed Jackie Robinson, but because he wanted to continue his career. And, you know, Rickey was such a good evaluator that all he got for Dixie Walker was Preacher Rowe and Billy Cox, who wound up being, you know, great cogs in those Dodger teams that remained contenders, you know, through the 50s.
I think, Roger, do you have a comment you want to say?
Well, I don't want to take away from what is being said, but, you know, Mr. Lee, I want to tell you, I agree with your comments earlier when you were wondering whether my wrath would be incurred or not. No, not at all. I agree with you. There are some problems with baseball that even being a Yankee fan, I'm embarrassed by it. I'm a baseball fan first and foremost, and baseball does have some difficulties, and the Yankees take advantage of that, and they're able to take advantage of that. It would be beautiful to see the sport on a more equal footing. That may not comment exactly on what you said, but, you know, guys, I get it. I'm a baseball fan, and what the Yankees can get away with is unbelievable.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that the Yankees get away with it because the other teams feel they make money when the Yankees come into town. And, you know, that, and even that may not be as great as it used to be. And it didn't only occur under free agency either, I might add. You know, when the American League in the 50s was losing attendance dramatically, and so many teams relied on the Yankees coming in, you know, to help the gate, you know. So it's difficult, but, you know, the one thing that keeps me hopeful is that there hasn't been a work stoppage since 1994. Even though if there hadn't been for 9/11, there might have been one in 2001. And I think both sides on the labor fence realize that you have to play the games, you know, and it looks like, you know, football especially and basketball are now going through their crisis times, maybe especially football. I would like to see baseball capitalize on it. So we'll see what happens. But as long as they play the games, I'm confident that, you know, baseball, you know, will survive and maybe even prosper. You know, the problem is that the chronically have-not franchises, and I don't know what can be done about that. I mean, you need smarter management brains, and as we all know from every walk of life, brains are not equally divided into, you know, 30. It is a problem, but to repeat, if they play the games, I think we're going to see more and more good competition. And the thing about watching baseball and understanding baseball, you must be patient, you know. And this is not a kind of country that seems to be patient. But believe me, I just came back from the Cape Cod League, which I hope your listeners have a chance to get up there at some time in their lives. I had been wanting to go every year, really, for the last 30, and I finally said for my birthday I'm going to go up. And I saw a few games, and it's all free. It's run by volunteers, and the major people in the community supporting these teams. And I got to see, for the Red Sox fans who are listening tonight, I got to see Mike Yastrzemski have three quality at bats without getting any hits, but he's just going to go back to Vanderbilt next year. And you see the kids rake the field, hose the field before the game. It's what baseball used to be, you know. And I know the new world of computers and all these devices that people have now don't want that kind of patience, maybe. But for an old timer like myself to see all generations at these parks, you know, it was just incredibly thrilling to see. And if you look at the papers today, while I still am sad for where my team has gone, and I call them the Warrioles now. They're not the Orioles, they're the Warrioles. I remain a loyal fan, and, you know, although I have to admit I don't go to see them play the Yankees. I mean, to me it's like going to see the Harlem Globetrotters play the Washington Generals. And but, you know, that's because of bad management. What can I say? So
I just want to make one last comment about the book, and then I'd like to go back to talking baseball. I thought some of the things that had been said back then with Jackie Robinson was, the only word I can say is disgusting. I remember he was talking with somebody in the organization. They were watching them play, and Jackie Robinson made a great play, and Branch said something about, have you ever seen a human being make such a great play? And the guy said, do you consider him a human being?
Right. Well, you know, the thing about Ricky, and I don't think he gets credit for this enough. I mean, Clay Harper was the person who made that comment. I mean, do you really think that a Negro is a human being? And he was raised in Mississippi. I mean, a lot of the folks down there, and unfortunately for Rays fans, the Twins just tied it up on Delmon Young's home run. And Delmon Young, of course, the former Ray. So that's, you know, that's, again, you got to be mentally tough. You know, Jeff Niemann was pitching a strong game. I don't know if he'd ever pitched in Hudson Valley, but Delmon Young, who's really come through, and to talk about patience, he certainly, you know, Bartlett and Garza had been the ones who had really come through for Tampa, but now Young is making that trade look good for the Twins. Well, anyway, it's tied, and so, you know, we continue. But, you know, to go back, the way Ricky dealt with these people, I really think he deserves more credit than he's gotten. I mean, he told Hopper, listen, there's nothing I can say to you if you feel that way, but are you going to manage Robinson the way you would manage any player? And he said, yes, you know, you're my employer, you're my boss. At the end of the year, in spring training the next year, he asked Ricky, could Jackie come back to play in Montreal? So things changed, you know. And Bobby Bregan, who just passed away, was one of those players who didn't want to play with Robinson, and he wound up, you know, admiring him tremendously. So I think it's important to tell these stories because until we realize that there is prejudice still around, we're not going to get to a better place than we are. But the great thing about Ricky is he had this saying in his office framed. It's that he who will not reason is a bigot. He who cannot reason is a fool. He who dares not to reason is a slave. And he tried to get people to reason. And and that part of him, I think, is I tried to bring out that it's not a caricature. It was really what he was about, you know. And you know, both he and Jackie Robinson were type A personalities. So, you know, if you didn't want to reason with him, or if he thought you were a fool or a bigot, he didn't do much. Wouldn't waste too much time with you. And Jackie Robinson was ready to fight you if you were like that. But together, they were an incredible team. And I think a sadness for Robinson, and certainly for New York fans, was when Ricky left to go to Pittsburgh, was forced out, because O'Malley then had 7 years to tell New York, I want a new stadium or I'm going to leave. And, you know, if Ricky had stayed here, there's no way that team's going to wind up in L.A. But, you know,
yeah.
That's a, but, you know, speaking from California, it was obviously a plus for the people of Southern California. So the great thing about baseball, we get frustrated in barely watching and looking at the larger scene, but somehow it survives because it's such a beautiful game and it's so much a part of our culture, you know. And you know that he who wants to understand baseball, this country, had better understand baseball. The great scholar who came to become a renowned professor, Jacques Barzin, said in the 50s, and I think it's still true.
I think we may take another break here. After that, we'll get back, and I've got some topics on baseball that I'd like to get your opinion on. But right now, I think you'll enjoy this version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, just to root for the hometown for every tool, Casey Blue. On a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Kate said, no, I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I ever get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
And there you go. How'd you enjoy that?
Now, is that the Von Tozer singing, the actual composer of the song?
I'm not sure. I'll have to check on that.
Yeah. I know it's, you know, here's another example of where baseball is so much tied to our history. If you, the Katie Casey mentioned in the verse to that song, that the composer of the song had a girlfriend, in fact, a fiance, who was a suffragist, and she wanted, you know, women have the right to vote, and so he dedicated that song to her. And there's some recent research come out about that, which I find so exciting, you know. And it's just another example of, you know, that a girl didn't want to go to a show. She wanted to go to a game, you know, where, you know, all these men were playing, and it's the American pastime. So it's just another example of how baseball is so deeply connected to our history, and it can't be destroyed.
See, that's why I love talking to people who know their baseball history, because I did not know all of that. Now I do. Going to some topics on baseball, and I know how you already feel about this subject, but what do you think of the DH?
I don't like it. At times, I feel that it's pretty ludicrous that this great game of ours is played with two sets of rules, but I think it's going to be a long time before there's ever going to be agreement on one set of rules, and the DH has now been in existence, hard to believe, for 37 years. So so many young people have grown up with it. I mean, I'm glad there's a non-DH league, but we have to put up with it seems. Now, I don't like it, though. I mean, because I think the game is about checks and balances, like the Constitution, and that a good hitting pitcher can help you win a game, and I think pitchers should be able to hit the ball, you know. But you see, everything is so specialized now, Zeke. You know, every manager, it seems, wants to use five pitches to win a game, five pitchers, you know. And, I mean, I don't like that either, you know. And I hope Nolan Ryan is able to change that culture, you know, by having his pitchers go deeper into games, you know. I think a lot of people are rooting for him to do it, you know.
My feelings on the DH is I don't like it either. The only good thing about it is it's something to argue about.
Exactly.
Which we'd like to do.
Exactly.
The other thing is, you know, people say, oh, it's a horrible thing to watch a pitcher bat. Well, let me tell you something. It's horrible seeing a terrible fielder play left field. So why don't we have, do it like football. We'll have an offensive team and a defensive team.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because Robin Roberts, one of my favorite people in baseball, one of the first people I interviewed when I was starting to do the Imperfect Diamond, because he is the man, along with Jim Bunning, who brought Marvin Miller into baseball. And Roberts' idea on the DH, which had just started a few years earlier, was, well, let's experiment with two platoon baseball. It might be an exciting game, you know. I don't think anyone ever has, you know. So the important thing is, you know, that there shouldn't be too much change, you know. And I'm not for it, but you still win with pitching and defense, you know. But in this world where people want guys who strike out 15 people like Strasburg and hit home runs, the trend is the other direction. I must say, though, as the steroid era, or the excess use of the performance-enhancing drugs, is now fading into the past, thank God, I think that there might be a chance for a discussion about the DH. But I'm not privy to any of it right now.
Now, there's no subject a while back. It no longer exists. But we had artificial turf. And I was wondering what you thought, how would the Cardinals of the 80s have done if they did not have artificial turf?
Not as well, clearly. They built that team to run. And they had Jack Clark, who would hit the ball out of every place. that they sure wouldn't have done as well, and Vince Coleman certainly wouldn't have had the meteoric career that he had, that when he became a free agent here with the Mets, that went down in a hurry, you know. So I don't think they would have been as good. But while Whitey Herzog was a good manager in any system, he heard him say that he was offered the Red Sox job, but he didn't want to manage in Fenway Park because he really loved the running game much more. You know.
Now, one of the newer things that some people like, some people don't, is the wild card. What do you think?
Well, as long as they don't add any more teams to it, the wild card is all right, just because the schedule is so ridiculous now. You know, I mean, part of the charm of baseball, and while older people got so hooked on it, was that from 1903 to 1953, there were no, you had 16 teams, and every team played every other team 22 times, 11 at home, 11 in a row. I mean, the schedule now is so ridiculously unbalanced that a wild card makes sense in that regard, because at least we'll reward people winning games, you know. So and again, this is something now that you might say it's tradition, you know, because it's been around for over 10 years, over almost 15 years, you know.
Now, the other thing is the All-Star Game. I hate what the commissioner did with whoever wins the All-Star Game gets the World Series advantage. What do you think?
I don't like it either. But again, it was dictated by television. I mean, Fox said, you know, this one, now it counts, you know. And actually, you know, home field advantage in baseball probably means less than it does in other sports, certainly basketball, as we saw in the recent, you know, Celtic Lakers series. So I don't like it, but again, it's not something that I get on the warpath about. I mean, what I want to see is better balance, but, you know, competitive balance, but until they distribute the brains better and the money better, I don't know how that's going to happen. You know, I would like to see some schedule changes so that it's not so ridiculous that one team will play another team 10 times and another team will play another team 6 times. And San Diego will wind up playing Milwaukee for the right to get into the playoffs, and when they haven't played Milwaukee all year. I mean, I think that's absurd, you know.
Now, what's your thought on pitch counts? I mean, I find it amazing how many innings players, you know, pitchers used to pitch long ago, and now pitchers are really held back.
Well, I understand why they're doing it, but again, I'm on Nolan Ryan's side here, that he wants people to pitch tired, and he doesn't want them to be hampered by an artificial count. I mean, you know, there are two good reasons why this has come in. You know, the amount invested in the player and the fear of injury, and yet there's no doubt that more people are getting injured with pitch counts than they were in the old days, you know. So, but I'm not an ideologue on this one way or the other, you know. If you have proper mechanics and you know what you're doing out there, I obviously think you can pitch longer in the games. You know, what really gets me is how managers really want to use 5 pitchers in a game now, it seems, you know. But, you know, Ryan is trying to instill more stamina in his starters, and I think a lot of if your starters are your best pitchers, they should work into the seventh and eighth innings most of the time, you know. And I'm also, I think, in another thing I'd like to see less reliance on is this closer business. You know, I think a lot of people, and there's been an interesting study on this, that if you go back 110 years of baseball history, the people pitching the ninth inning are not any more significant than the people pitching the seventh inning.
Right.
And yet,
right.
And yet the closer has become the big fetish now. That, you know, team, can, they say, cannot win without a closer, you know. And you really, because you've had several generations of kids now coming in the pro ball and the majors, they don't want to pitch after the seventh inning, you know. And what is baffling to me is that sometimes they've only thrown 90 pitches in the seven innings and they still don't want to pitch the eighth inning.
Right. And with the relievers, I think really better ones are the eighth inning guys who have men on the base usually, where the main ace reliever usually comes in with nobody on.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, when you look back at Fingers and Gossage, both deservedly in the Hall of Fame, I mean, they were 2-3 inning closers. You know, they weren't called closer. And of course, Suter, I guess, being the first, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, with the recent events of the pitcher denied of his no-hitter, what do you think of the instant replay? I mean, I think the home run call should definitely be instant replayed. Of course, balls and strikes shouldn't. But what about just a play at first base like what happened in that game?
Well, you know, it's a 3-0 game, okay? The umpire blew the call, but how many other calls in that game did he blow? I mean, you can't, you know, it's a sad story. And of course, in Galarraga's case, he was in the minor leagues at the beginning of the series, almost the perfect model of a journeyman who hasn't done much since that game. You know, and the way he handled it and the way the umpire handled it, I thought was wonderful. They, you know, mistakes are made, you know, but I certainly wouldn't. It's unfortunate, but you certainly don't go into technology to change it. What I'd like to see, I'm not even sure if every foul pole were standard size throughout baseball, and you know, very tall. I'm not sure that I'm for the replay on that. You know, because once you allow replay on anything controversial, then you're going to say, well, calls at second base, you know. So I'm for, you know, uniform regulations in the ballparks and, you know, the best umpires you can get, you know.
We've had different kinds of errors in baseball. Long ago we had the dead ball error and more recently the steroids era. What do you think will be the next era in baseball?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not a prophet. I mean, I'd like to see the pitching and defense and just enough offense era, you know. You see, the great thing about baseball, as we think about it and with the questions you're asking me, I mean, what sport has runs, hits, and errors built into the line score, you know? Now, I mean, yeah, I guess you can say in football, you know, there are interceptions and fumbles, so... But, you know, the nature of baseball is it's about failure and mistakes, you know. And I think the more you accept that and try to minimize them, you know, the better you'll be. But I'd like to see it as a pitching and defense error, and I'm not sure that the I'm going to see that come true, you know. But that would be my.
Now, we have 5 minutes left in our hour program, but we can extend if you want to stay a little longer.
Well, I actually have a couple more shows to do tomorrow, and I'm losing my voice. So I haven't done one of these in a while, Zeke, but I'm fortified with a lot of water. So, I mean, are any calls coming in?
No calls. But I do have an appropriate song I could end the show with.
Okay.
With the Brent Schwicke book.
Okay.
But I will give you a chance to give out your URL for your site.
Okay. I have my website is leeloenfish.com, and my books are available there. I blog every couple of weeks, and I had put some thoughts in about why there's so many perfect games this year, and my theory is that there's just so many hitters are swinging for the fences that a pitcher who is on his stuff can really take advantage of that. You know, another thing that I am opposed to is this attempt to put a statistic into everything and to think that a number can explain how this game is played, because as I said before, it's a game of mistakes and minimizing them and making something of the mistakes if they do happen. So it's been a pleasure though to talk to you tonight, and I always love talking about baseball, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back on. I just want to check if Roger has any comments he'd like to make.
Well, as a matter of fact, Mr. Loenfish, I want to thank you for joining us this evening. Let me tell you, several people in the chat room have commented just simply, hell, man, I'm learning a lot of stuff here today. You have us enthralled with your knowledge and the stories, and I enjoyed it. I will say I agree with you quite a bit, especially the Orioles. Look, I'm 41. I remember when the Orioles were a feared team, and now the Orioles, it's like, what happened? And
well, you know, Peter Angelos is two words that can explain it, and it's you know, like it is in so many things in life, that it's a lot easier to destroy something. You can do it quickly, and rebuilding is hard, you know. I mean, if I had a magic wand, I would like to see fewer major league teams, because there are not enough major league players for 30 teams. But that's not going to happen. So it's the search for good players who know how to play the game must continue. And so we'll, I mean, I saw it. And
With a minute left, we're going to have to go. I'd like to say thank you for coming again, and I just want to play the song. I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay, nice being with you on the two coasts.
Yes, thank you, Lee.
Good day.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 oh. I say O-M, O-M-A, O-M-A-L, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y, oh, really? No O'Malley. Sandy Koufax, oh, my Drysdale, Maury Wills, I love you so. And we defy, defy the J-I, J-I-N, J-I-N-T, J-I-N-T-S. Orlando Cepeda is at bat with the bases jammed. Orlando Cepeda with a wham, bam, he hit a grand slam in the very first inning, but it's only the beginning. In the fight, like a fight, we get two on and away, then fairly hits into a double play. Here comes Big Frank Howard, a siree. Boy, what a swing! Strike three. O-dem B, O-dem B-U, B-U-M, B-U-M-S. Them bums, them dry bums. Oh, they may be bums, but they're my bums.
All right, I think we'll end the show here. What do you think, Rob?
Okay. Okay, good night, guys. Thanks.